Hello, I'm Barbara Troutner, and we're going to talk about my favorite subject today, urinary tract infections. These are not relevant. So the problem is we have so little time. I really struggle each year. I need to make sure this comes in under 45 minutes. And UTI is so interesting. We could talk about UTI for weeks. However, focusing specifically on things that I think could be covered on boards, we will talk about acute cystitis in women, recurrent cystitis in women, asymptomatic bacteria, catheter-associated UTI, pyelonephritis and complicated UTI, and then what I call urosepsis and worse, which is things that you may get consulted on as an infectious diseases doctor. First, we have to have some philosophy. I think everyone needs to understand where the evidence base for urinary tract infection is coming from. So we tend to think about UTI as a monolithic entity, but it's not. Most of the evidence for UTI came from studying premenopausal women with acute cystitis. In them, their chance of having asymptomatic bacteria on any given day is 5% or less. So when they have bacteria in their bladders, they tend to have symptoms and pain, and they tend to report it. And that is what we consider UTI or cystitis. But see, the problem is that the clinical scenario just doesn't apply to most of the populations that we're seeing in the hospital. And a lot of what we're seeing in clinic, we're seeing older adults. Take this woman who lives in long-term care. On any given day, she has about a 50% chance of having bladder colonization with bacteria. So if she wakes up and falls out of bed and hits her head, was it caused by the bacteria? Probably not. But if you test her urine, there's a 50% chance you're going to find bacteria there. So UTI gets blamed for a lot of things in older women, but really that's the bladder colonization. Now, what do we do with this man who is getting dialysis? He barely produces urine, maybe voids once a day, maybe every other day. If you test his urine, it's going to be sludge. It's going to have 2 to 3 bacteria. It's going to have mucus. So if he has a fever, is it in any way related to his urine? Should we even culture it? So some of these things don't have answers and won't be tested on boards, but I think it's really important to understand that UTI is not the same thing when you look at different populations. So I work at the Houston VA. So my patient populations are men and older adults in long-term care. And I see a lot of patients who also require urinary catheters for bladder drainage. And we also have a lot of people with spinal cord injury. But the urinary tract evidence treatment base, for the most part, is from premenopausal women, the powerhouse for the UTI research when a lot of the clinical trials that form our evidence base were done was at the University of Washington in Seattle. And patients were recruited into those trials through the student and faculty health of the University of Washington. So you had a pretty educated population of female college students and university staff in those clinical trials. So let's jump into the questions. We're gonna go through a series of questions today. Question number one, we have a 24-year-old woman who is evaluated for cystitis symptoms that she's had for 3 days. She has no fever, feels, chills, flank pain, or vaginal discharge. She had some similar symptoms about 3 months ago, was treated with trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole, and that worked well. Her vital signs are good. And on microscopic exam, she has a lot of white blood cells. She has some red cells. She has bacteria present. Her urine pregnancy test is negative. Remember to send the pregnancy test. I work at the VA. I don't always remember. That is key. So what are you going to do for this woman when you're treating her empirically? Are you going to give her nitrofurantoin? You're going to give her another round of trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole. How about fosfomycin? Should we be using ciprofloxacin? Should we just skirt the whole antibiotic issue and give her ibuprofen? Give me a minute to think here. Okay, so it's tricky, but nitrofurantoin is probably your best choice for uncomplicated cystitis, particularly when someone recently got back to it. Because recent exposure to a specific antibiotic can increase the risk of having a resistant organism in the urine subsequently. And so she had the Bactrim recently, so I think you would not want to use trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole. Fosfomycin would be okay. It costs at least $100 for dose in the US compared to $3 to $5 for the Bactrim. And it's not, you don't have susceptibility testing on this routinely, so you're probably not going to choose that. Cipro, we try to avoid that when other options are available, as in this case, ibuprofen. There have been a lot of trials coming out of Europe on trying to see if women need antibiotics for cystitis. And the bottom line is they do. Antibiotics resolve the pain symptoms faster and prevent pyelonephritis. That said, people in these trials were the, as previously mentioned, the healthy adult women who could detect bladder symptoms. So we're going to talk about asymptomatic bacteria, which doesn't need to be treated at all. But this is when people have symptomatic UTI, they merit relief of their symptoms with antibiotics. All right, so the IDSA guidelines on uncomplicated cystitis are from 2010, and they were limited to premenopausal women, mostly managed in the outpatient setting. So what we have now and coming very soon is complicated UTI guidelines, which will cover men and women with infections of the urinary tract that probably lead to hospitalization or, you know, close management in the outpatient setting. Those should be published, I really hope, this October. But so for now, for uncomplicated UTI, we're still working with the 2010 guidelines. So if you're asked questions about it, the first line agents are nitrofurantoin, trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole, and fosfomycin. Your alternative choices, which are not as good in first line, are fluoroquinolones and beta-lactams. A key thing to remember, though, is I want to draw your attention to this one caveat in the guidelines that avoid trimethoprim if resistance exceeds 20%, how you're supposed to know in your outpatient clinic. If you don't have an antibiogram, I don't know. But also avoid it if used for UTI in the previous 3 months. So I think that recommendation still holds, and that's what we were applying in this case for our patient. Note that pivmecillinam is in here, and we're going to talk about that a little more because it is now approved in the United States. In fact, it's been approved for more than a year to treat uncomplicated UTI. So I guess I should put that on the slide now. But how long do you treat? Nitrofurantoin is a 5-day course. Bactrim is 3 days. Fosfomycin is 1 day, but I feel like we may start to see longer courses of that antibiotic as it's used more. Because I'm not sure the one dose is necessarily fully effective. In fact, one trial comparing 1 day of fosfo to 5 days of nitrofurantoin found that the 5 days of nitrofurantoin were better for cystitis. So it opens the question of if you use fosfo, you know, repeated it 2 days later, would it have compared as well? So talking about nitrofurantoin, resistance in E. coli is uncommon. So I think it's a really fantastic drug for E. coli cystitis, and I think it's a fantastic drug for prophylaxis of UTI. It doesn't get real high levels in tissue or blood, so you wouldn't use it for pylo. It also makes the urine look a little bit more yellow. So I do think people in clinical trials who get this drug tend to know they're getting something. So that could mess up the placebo thing. It's not going to work if you've got any of these bugs written here. Pseudomonas, Proteus, Serratia. It's not going to work well if you've got Gleb or Enterobacter. And you can use it if your GFR is greater than 30. You used to say greater than 60, but greater than 30 should be fine. What are the adverse events? There's rare acute pulmonary toxicity and rare subacute or chronic diffuse pneumonitis, probably dose dependent and mainly seen in women in long-term care put on this drug daily for 5 years for UTI prophylaxis, and no one ever remembers to take them off of it. So it just favors using the lowest possible dose for your chronic prophylaxis. Hepatitis is rare and nausea is pretty common, but the twice daily formulation has reduced the nausea. I tell people take it with food. Fosfo, we don't use fosfo much. It's a single 3-gram dose that you dissolve in water, not hot water. You don't want to boil it and drink. And it's kind of got a niche for your ESBL and KPC producing Enterobacterales, in which it can be dosed as 3 grams every 48 to 72 hours, depending on what you're treating. And I mean, in terms of cystitis versus pyelo versus a different infection. IV fosfomycin did not get approval in the U.S. It's associated with hypokalemia, fluid retention, and elevated LFTs. Here's why fosfo is problematic. First of all, it's not, you can't test for it on the standard panels, or at least standard panels don't include it yet. So it's, you know, you spread, so the lab tech needs to spread the organism on a plate and then drop a disc or a strip. So these colonies always pop up within the zone. And so the question is the zone with this white line or is the zone between the arrows of the colony? And the U.S. looks at that one way and Europe looks at it a different way. Europe is more permissive, allowing the zone to be the outer part of the rim and the U.S. is using the distance between the colonies that are inside it. So we have trouble determining breakpoint standards for susceptibility for fosfomycin, which has impaired its uptake with clinicians. Quinolones, why can't we use them for everything? I think this is old news now, but they have a lot of side effects. Dysglycemia, tendon rupture damage, interstitial nephritis, neuropathy, diarrhea. I don't know if 3 days of quinolones for UTI is going to cause aortic aneurysm, but it sure sounds great when you want to, for stewardship reasons, encourage people not to use quinolones, and arrhythmias. I've actually seen a lot of these in my patients on longer-term quinolones. That said, there are cases where you need to use them and, you know, you shouldn't be afraid because of these, but I would discourage routine use of empiric quinolones for cystitis. Now, we have some new oral drugs for cystitis that have been FDA approved for uncomplicated UTI, and I could have given a 45-minute talk on these drugs. It's just so interesting to see new drugs available for cystitis. They are approved, but I would say none of them are widely available, if available at all. I think pivmecillinam, which has been used in Canada and the U.S. for a long time for UTI, really hasn't marketed itself in the U.S. or gotten on the insurance approvals. Gepotidacin, recently approved, is going to do the big campaign where it works with your insurance providers to become a feasible drug to use. And then sulopenem just got approved recently. So what can I tell you about these specific drugs? Pivmecillinam is effective against gram negatives and staph cypropithecus. It's related to mesillinam. So mesillinam is not effective against enterococcus, so it is not either. Gepotidacin blocks DNA topoisomerase. To me, that sounds a lot like a quinolone, but apparently it's somewhat different. It is effective against ESBL-producing Enterobacterales, staph cypropithecus, and Enterococcus faecalis. It does have diarrhea as a side effect, which I think is going to limit its popularity in treating UTI, and I think it's a five-day course. Sulopenem just got approved. It technically seems to me like a carbapenem, but it's different because it has a sulfur molecule in one part of the ring, making it a thiopenem. It's effective against ESBL, Enterobacterales, and staph cypropithecus. It did not get approval for complicated UTI, even though it has an IV formulation. So Gepo and sulopenem and pivmecillinam can all be effective against the ESBL-positive Enterobacterales. What these drugs don't cover is Pseudomonas. They also don't cover a VRE. What's going to be the place for these drugs? I think pivmecillinam is, it's already in the guidelines, is recommended first-line choice. And I don't think it's such a broad-acting agent that we have as many stewardship concerns. Gepo and sulopenem, particularly sulopenem, we have substantial stewardship concerns because we know that it is likely to trigger cross-resistance with carbapenems. So where the place will be for those, I don't know, but I am personally very excited to have some oral options for ESBL-positive organisms. And I think their place will be in step-down for complicated UTI when you want to go to oral therapy and you know that it's an ESBL organism. All right, moving on to audience response question two. These get a lot faster, by the way. There's just so much on uncomplicated UTI. And honestly, that's something you treat a ton, I'm sure, in clinic. And it's kind of thing all your friends and family ask you to treat. So it's good to be very strong on how to manage empirically uncomplicated UTI. So now we're going to talk about recurrent UTI in a 38-year-old woman. It's her third episode. It's culture proven in the past 12 months. Super inconvenient to her. She notes that sexual intercourse is usually related. If she's going to get a UTI, it's 1 to 2 days later. You offer her an antibiotic prescription to self-treat, but she travels internationally, and her last UTI cropped up on a 12-hour plane flight, and she just doesn't want to go through that experience ever again. So she wants a preventive strategy. She doesn't want the self-treat when the UTI crops up. So what are you going to give her? Nitrofurantoin for 24 months every day. Nitrofurantoin one dose after intercourse for 6 months, Cipro every day for 6 months, Bactrim twice a day for 6 months, or cranberry tablets. I have a lot of tempting choices there. All right, so we're going to go with intercourse causes her UTIs, so use an antibiotic after intercourse, because that is probably the best way to minimize her dosing exposure to nitrofurantoin. While preventing her from getting a UTI. That's why, and there's not clear guidance on how long to treat for prophylaxis, but usually recommendation is 3 to 6 months. And so taking it every day for 24 months would be a higher dose than needed and longer than you need. Cipro is not a good drug for prophylaxis. You are likely to see resistance. Bactrim twice daily for 6 months. You can use Bactrim daily for 6 months. You can use Bactrim 3 times a week for 6 months, but you don't need it twice daily. You don't usually use treatment level doses for UTI prophylaxis. Cranberry tablets, the jury is still out on that. And we'll talk about that a little bit more in a minute. So how do you prevent and manage recurrent UTI? Self-treatment coupled with urine collection for culture is an appropriate strategy. What is self-treatment? That means you see someone, a woman in your clinic who, I've even extrapolated this to men that I've seen, but are suffering from recurrent UTIs. They can pretty much tell you with their symptoms, it's a UTI. When they come in, you grow a specific bug in their culture. You prescribe them a course of antibiotics that that organism is susceptible to. You give them a urine culture cup and a standing order for a urine culture. And you say, next time you have UTI symptoms, get a clean catch specimen, refrigerate it until you can bring it to the lab, which you need to do within a day, and you can start the antibiotics. That's self-treatment. And then you need that urine culture just to back up and make sure that they are taking the right drug for what they have. You want to use a focused antibiotic and sparingly. You look for the triggers. If some people, it's like long car rides because they're fluid restricting and they get UTIs. So look for the trigger and have them use a dose of antibiotics around a trigger situation for 3 to 12 months. There's no real clarity on what to use, but there's some nice guidelines that summarize the evidence well from the American Urologic Association. And I put the link on the slide. So let's talk about non-antibiotic strategies to prevent recurrent UTI. There is a huge market out there. You've probably seen it on the internet. There, because we are failing to meet our patients' needs at preventing recurrent UTI. People are really suffering with a lot of bladder pain. And so, you know, there's a market of quasi-scientific things that grows up out there, like all sorts of liquid supplements you can drink, all sorts of cranberry things you can take. And there's really very little evidence for those. Cranberry, I put a question mark because there was a Cochrane review that found cranberry products were effective in pre- and postmenopausal women, but not effective in older adults and not effective in catheterized and not effective in children with neurogenic bladders. I just think we've yet to see a really strong evidence that cranberry products are helping, and they're so varied, diverse, expensive. It's hard to know what you would use. Behavioral changes, people probably already done those by the time they're suffering from recurrent UTI. You know, that's like voiding after intercourse, wiping in a certain direction. There's no clear evidence, though, that those work. D-mannose, there's evidence that probably doesn't work. Probiotics, no strong evidence. And again, a lot of these supplements are being marketed with really just spurious claims. What is likely helpful and or FDA approved is increasing fluid intake. A randomized controlled trial showed that having women drink 200 cc's more fluid per day made a difference. It may have been in decreasing UTI. Vaginal estrogen in postmenopausal women decreases recurrent UTI. And the methenamine, there have been two encouraging trials where methenamine was compared to antibiotic prophylaxis and seemed to be equally effective. I don't think either of those was blinded, though, and so a larger randomized controlled trial, placebo-controlled trial that's blinded is underway. I am using a fair bit of methenamine because it gives me something to do. All right, next question. We got a 69-year-old woman who came in for an annual checkup. She's feeling fine. She has some urine leakage, but it's really a stress incontinence situation, and it's not surprising because she had 3 vaginal births. So stress incontinence is almost the rule in some degree if you've had several vaginal births. And she has hypertension and some diabetes. Her BMI is 30, vital sign is fine. You do a dipstick urinalysis because you're looking for protein because she's diabetic, right? But unfortunately, someone notes that the urine has a bad smell. And then she has leukocyte esterase and nitrites. And so urinalysis is sent and has bacteria. So what are you going to do? Nitrofurantoin, Cipro, straight to cystoscopy. Why is she leaking urine? Urine culture and sensitivity, or call it a day. No further infectious workup. I think you all know the right answer. It's just hard to do in practice. And that is no further infectious workup. You weren't looking for a UTI. She has stress incontinence. It's no worse than usual. All you want to know is, does she have protein in urine? The white blood cells and bacteria are an incidental finding. If you treat her for the bacteria, you can temporarily cause it to go away, but it will come back because she still has the anatomic situation that's predisposing her for it, which is probably some urinary retention. And the organism will potentially be more resistant when it comes back. So this is wonderful. It's in the guidelines for asymptomatic bacteria. From IDSA, there's a table, shows the incidence of asymptomatic bacteria, which is just bladder colonization. So in diabetic women, you can see it's about 11 to 16%. In healthy premenopausal women, it's under 5%. But if you get into elderly people in long-term care, men and women, up to 50%. You leave in an indwelling catheter, more than 30 days, 100% of people have bacteria. So just because you find bacteria in the urine doesn't mean it's causing any sort of problem. You don't have to take my word for it. The Infectious Diseases Society of America, the American Board of Internal Medicine, and U.S. Preventive Services Task Force all say, please do not screen for bacteria. Please do not treat asymptomatic bacteria. So the IDSA guidelines on asymptomatic bacteria were pretty clear. They created this long list where you don't screen for or treat. And personally, if I were trying to memorize something, I would memorize the short list, which is where you do screen and treat for asymptomatic bacteria. Pregnant women and anyone that will have urologic surgery with mucosal trauma. Why? Because that bleeding can lead to bacteremia if they have bacteria in bladder. The U.S. Preventive Services Task Force continues to endorse screening for asymptomatic bacteria in pregnant women. The Canadian Task Force came out and gave it a weaker recommendation. But the main reason to screen for asymptomatic bacteria and treat in pregnant women is to prevent pyelonephritis, which in turn is associated with preterm labor and then in turn with low birth weight babies. The Canadian populations that form their evidence base are more homogeneous and more likely to get prenatal care than in the United States, where women tend to present later in pregnancy and sometimes without care. So in the US, there is a benefit for screening for asymptomatic bacteria once during pregnancy and treating it. So now we're going to bust up some myths. I love mythology. So let's go, but I hate to do this, but we're going to have to bust up some UTI myths that people are clinging to, and it's time to let them go. So these are what I would refer to as true facts. They are actually true. Bacteria in the bladder is not the same as UTI. It's just such a key point. And people don't know that. Don't feel badly if you didn't know that. There's a difference. Bacteria just means the bacteria are there. UTI means the person has symptoms related to the presence of that bacteria. Pyuria is not the same as UTI. In fact, it doesn't help much at all in the diagnosis of UTI. If it's absent, you're less likely to have a UTI, but could have been improper specimen processing. Foul-smelling urine is not equal to UTI. A lot of things people eat or consume make the urine smell foul. Sediment is not the same as UTI. It can mean there's bacteria or not, but it's not the same. Healthy bladders are not sterile in many people. So the take-home points, only order urine tests in patients with urinary symptoms. The best thing you can do with asymptomatic bacteria is leave it alone. Pyuria is not a marker for UTI, and changes in the urine are not reliable markers for UTI. So now you're pretty frustrated. It's like, what have I left you with? But first, I'm going to keep explaining about the pyuria. We'll go over this briefly. I love this paper. 120 women with recurrent UTI were followed sequentially for 90 days. And each day they wrote down their symptoms, and they provided urine for dipstick testing, and they provided urine for a quick slide culture looking for bacteria. And then the authors of this paper created scenarios. Each horizontal line represents a different scenario. And what we see on the top line, and this is scenarios that they observed in the group, what we see on the top line is what my mental model thought was going on with these UTIs, recurrent UTIs. This means they had UTI symptoms. This means they got antibiotics. The red is the white count in the urine. The blue is the E. coli count in the urine. So once this person starts antibiotics for their UTI symptoms, the E. coli goes to nothing and the white blood cells fall. I thought that's what was happening in UTI, but no, a far more pattern that they observed was this, which looks like complete chaos. But this was a very common pattern. UTI symptoms, finished antibiotics here, and the white count goes down and then the white count goes up. And the white count goes down and up and down and up, and the bacteria go down, and the bacteria go up, and the bacteria go down, and the bacteria go up, but the patient never had UTI symptoms that got bad enough for them to report it after that. So the positive predictive value of pyuria for having E. coli in the urine was 4%. So again, not very helpful. And this is another slide that I absolutely love. This is in catheterized patients. The other one was healthy outpatient women. This is white blood cell count. This is a bacterial colony count. This is people with newly placed urinary catheters. You can see like a correlation line would be going straight up here. It is flat, flat, flat. It looks like a Houston parking lot. There is no correlation between white blood cell count and colony forming units in catheterized patients until you get to these ridiculous high counts that you don't usually see, like 10 to the 8th, 10 to the 10th. So in hospitalized patients with urinary catheters, you can't use pyuria to predict that there's going to be bacteria. All right, armed with this information, we're going to move on to a different case. 75-year-old man is seen in the pre-op clinic because he is going to have a bladder biopsy for hematuria. And he's having a really big week because he's also going to get his knee replaced. Other than the hematuria, he doesn't have any urinary specific symptoms. And we're going to throw in all the red herrings because it's an ID case. So he had kidney transplant 3 years ago related to diabetes. Physical exam, his vital signs are normal. He has an effusion in the right left knee, but it's chronic. No change in his baseline creatinine clearance. On urinalysis, he has a white count of 10. He has 100 red cells. He has 4 plus bacteria. And his urine culture grows a lot of Klebsiella. Kidney ultrasound just shows a transplanted kidney. So, which he does get antibiotics. Finally, we're in case number 4, and I'm going to let you give antibiotics to someone. So why does he get antibiotics? Because he is getting cystoscopy and biopsy, because he has diabetes, because he has kidney transplant, or because we're going to place a knee prosthesis. Now, they're all tempting. What are you going to say? So the answer is he does get antibiotics, and it's because of the cystoscopy and biopsy. If you don't treat bacteria prior to a bladder biopsy, it's like working in a contaminated surgical field. The risk of bacteremia is pretty high. Diabetes mellitus, kidney transplant, you don't need to treat asymptomatic bacteria in transplant more than 1 month after transplant. And knee prosthesis, we didn't fully address it in the 2019 ASP guidelines, but since then, there's been a very large cohort study of 68,000 veterans who were undergoing either placement of a heart valve or a vascular graft or an artificial joint. And out of those, there were only 2 cases where an organism collected in the urine prior to surgery and not treated was subsequently found in the surgical wound. Again, this is talking about 68,000 cases. And in both cases where the pre-op urine culture predicted what was in the surgical wound infection afterwards, it was Staph aureus. Probably didn't come originally from the urine. So I don't think that there's strong evidence that you need to treat what's in the urine prior to placement of a prosthetic joint, but I'm not sure you'll get asked about that. You will probably get asked about the asymptomatic bacteria question in the older woman without symptoms. And the answer is don't do a culture, don't treat it. All right, question number 5. 46-year-old man is admitted to the hospital for repair of aortic dissection. He gets a urinary catheter prior to surgery. The repair is successful. He goes to the SICU. He has diabetes and heart failure, so they're monitoring his fluid output. So in addition to taking out that catheter as soon as possible, which of the following would decrease his risk of catheter-associated UTI? Special cleansing of the meatal area with a special antiseptic, routinely changing the catheter every 3 days, screening for and treating his bacteria, so get out ahead of it, keep the collecting bag below the level of the bladder, or use an antiseptic or antibiotic-coated urinary catheter. Again, lots of tempting options. I want you to pay attention to this one because I feel like cauti prevention has become a board review topic. All right, so the right answer here is keep the collecting bag below the level of the bladder. Let the gravity do its job. See, I showed you something flowing downstream to help you remember. So you don't want urine to be refluxing back from the collecting bag into the bladder, up the ureters, and into the kidneys. However, daily cleansing of the meatal area with special antiseptics has been found to be ineffective. Routine catheter change is more likely to introduce bacteria. You don't screen for and treat bacteria because the bacteria will come right back as long as that catheter is in place and it'll be more resistant. And antiseptic-coated urinary catheters really have had minimal impact. We're now going to get into complicated UTI. A 37-year-old woman with a history of recurrent UTI developed her typical UTI symptoms of frequency and dysuria 5 days ago. As happens so often lately, instead of seeking medical care, she talked to a close friend who recommended a nutritional supplement instead of antibiotics. And the symptoms did not resolve. And she's kind of noted some low back pain. And then this morning she vomited. So she does come in to see you. Of course, it could have been an access to care issue too. You can't be judgmental. But in the office, her temperature is elevated. Her blood pressure is fine. Her heart rate is a little bit up. But she's not vomiting anymore and can sip water. So you're considering outpatient management for her. And you don't have any prior urine cultures to guide your therapy. However, she told you she had a UTI 3 months ago, but she took some antibiotics, but she doesn't know what she took. Assuming you can manage her as an outpatient, what empiric treatment would you offer? Oral trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole, oral cipro, one dose of ceftriaxone or gentamicin followed by oral cipro, keflexin, nitrofurantoin. So what we're going to recommend is she had antibiotics recently, and you don't know what they are. But if they were for UTI, it's pretty likely she got trimethoprim sulfamethoxazole, cipro, or nitrofurantoin. You don't know. But you don't have cultures to guide you. So you're worried that she could have an organism that's resistant to oral options. So therefore, the best choice is ceftriaxone or gentamicin IM, plus followed by the oral option, cipro or Bactrim. Keflex is just not as good a drug. The beta-lactams, particularly the first, second-generation oral beta-lactams, are really never compared well to Bactrim and cipro in clinical trials of treating cystitis. Some of it may be bioavailability. They may need a higher dose. They also seem to need a longer duration of treatment. In this case, we think we're treating pyelonephritis, so I'd try to go with a first-line drug. So how do you manage pyelonephritis? Nowadays, we are thinking of pyelonephritis as a complicated UTI, although the prior IDSA guidelines had pylo in the outpatient setting as an uncomplicated UTI. Clinicians are increasingly thinking of complicated UTI as something that means the urinary tract infection has spread beyond the bladder to the kidneys, to the bloodstream, to the prostate. That would make it a complicated UTI. Or it originated beyond the bladder, like you have a nephrostomy tube. That would be a complicated UTI. So empiric oral therapy for pyelonephritis or complicated UTI can be Bactrim for 7 days, fluoroquinolones for 5 to 7 days. But you might want to consider a one-time dose of ceftriaxone and gentamicin while awaiting cultures if you're doing outpatient therapy. There are oral beta-lactam options, third-generation cephalosporins and amoxiclavulanate, but those are less preferred. And then if your patient is sick enough to need empiric antibiotic therapy, that opens it up to IV cephalosporins like ceftriaxone, piperacillin, carbapenems, fluoroquinolones. You want to avoid nitrofurantoin and probably fosfomycin, just not as much data, and using that for pylo. All right, question number 7. We have a 68-year-old. Now we're in the area of urosepsis or worse, if you're wondering where we got to in this lecture. We have a 68-year-old diabetic man with congestive heart failure, vascular disease, and benign prostatic hypertrophy who presented with 2 days of vomiting, abdominal pain, and confusion. This is a real case that we saw. His vital signs, temp's a little up, blood pressure is not looking good, heart rate is high, respiratory rate is high. He was obtunded, but they thought he had some epigastric tenderness. His white count was really high, his platelets were low, his creatinine doubled. His urinalysis looked bad. He had a lot of white cells, red cells. They quote read no bacteria. I need y'all to know that these are read by light microscope and a computer algorithm. So if you have a lot of red cells, they're round, they can fragment, they can look a lot like bacteria. And so the computer can get confused reading between bacteria and red cells or occasionally white cells if there's a lot of red cells or white cells. So you can't necessarily trust that read on whether bacteria are present or not. So the team was, needless to say, pretty focused on his elevated troponin, his ST elevation MI. And so he was admitted to the CCU and started on treatment for his heart attack. He had labile blood pressure. He required pressure support. So everyone's really working on stabilizing him. They intubate him. Hospital day 2, he had blood cultures that had grown, Klebsiella pneumoniae in 4 out of 4 bottles. So everyone started scratching their heads like, where did that come from? He had had a KUB of his abdomen performed at admission, and this is what it looked like. So kind of looks like a loop of bowel, right? I mean, that's what I would have thought it was. So what would you order next? There are probably 2 good answers, abdominal ultrasound, abdominal CT, nasogastric tube, or stool for C. diff testing. So there's one best answer. And it's abdominal CT. And why? Because you're looking for gas in the kidney. This looked like a loop of bowel to everyone, including me. It's actually emphysematous pyelonephritis. It is gas in the kidney. His kidney had been attacked by bacteria, in this case, Klebsiella, which can convert to anaerobic and produce gas. And it, the gas had really replaced the parenchyma of his kidney. So what happened? He was too unstable to go for nephrectomy, so he had percutaneous drainage of the right kidney. It grew Klebsiella. After a few weeks in the ICU, he was stable enough for nephrectomy. That kidney was too far gone. Sometimes you can salvage it with drainage, but not in his case. And 9 months later, he had coronary artery bypass surgery. And when I checked 7 years later, was still doing fine. So our patients are pretty tough. So how do you manage emphysematous pyelonephritis? 95% of the cases are in patients with poorly controlled diabetes. People who come in sicker tend to do worse. The organisms are your typical gram negatives for the most part. And often the diagnosis is delayed because it's not, you know, you see gas in the abdominal films and nobody gets excited about that. You got to differentiate it from renal abscess or papillary necrosis. CAT scan is helpful for that. Initially, you want to drain it. In some cases, the kidney has enough preserved tissue to recover, and so, but some do have to go on to nephrectomy. Now, this is a different entity from emphysematous cystitis, which is gas-forming organisms invade the wall of the bladder. The popular New England Journal imaging topic, both by CAT scan and another CAT scan. And emphysematous cystitis has a predilection for women and is most commonly an incidental finding, like you happened to get an x-ray, because it really just presents with bladder pain. You don't expect gas bubbles in the urine. Gas bubbles in the urine are more like a fistula with the intestines somewhere along the way. But the organisms produce the gas and you treat it by relieving bladder obstruction, you know, put in a catheter if you need to, but it typically responds well to medical management. For our last question, this was another real patient of ours, 57-year-old man with spinal cord injury and neurogenic bladder, and so he's a chronic indwelling catheter. In the past, he had a fever and blood grew Staph aureus and Pseudomonas. At that time, his urine grew lactose-negative, gram-negative rods, and gram-positive organisms. So it could have been the same, but wasn't worked out because it was multiple species. A year prior, he had a fever, and his blood grew Serratia, E. coli, and Pseudomonas, and his urine had two organisms. This time, they did work it up, and two of them matched. Both times, he was treated with appropriate antibiotics, and his fever went away, and he stabilized. He's had a lot of urine cultures. They all grew multiple urinary pathogens. I was going to put him in a research protocol, and so we did a screening abdominal ultrasound just to make sure he didn't have a lot of reflux and showed a big mass in the right kidney. So in addition to CAT scan, what should we do next? Renal biopsy, 3 to 6 months of antibiotics to really get rid of the bacteria, percutaneous drainage, or nephrectomy. I was a fellow at the time, and I thought that he had kidney cancer, and so I was very sad about this. And instead, someone said, oh no, Barbara, this is xanthogranulomatous pyelonephritis. He's had recurrent infections repeatedly and repeatedly positive urine cultures and repeatedly getting into the bloodstream. What is xanthogranulomatous pyelonephritis? Often seen in people with neurogenic bladders, a stone forms in the renal collecting ducts and gets larger and larger and larger, causes obstruction. Urine gets backed up behind it, gets contaminated with the bacteria, really destroy the tissue, and you get these lipid-laden macrophages that make the whole thing look yellow. So that is a destroyed kidney from xanthogranulomatous pyelonephritis. They call this the bear paw sign, but it doesn't always have those specific, you know, rounded things on scan. So it's frequently mistaken for tumor. You don't want to do a biopsy of a renal tumor. That's another one of those things where you can see the biopsy tract with tumor cells, so you wouldn't be biopsying if you thought it was a renal tumor. But it's a chronic polymicrobial infection. The renal tissue becomes destroyed. It's not going to get better. It needs to be treated with nephrectomy. So our patient, I was so excited to rush to his bed and tell him he didn't have kidney cancer, which I've since learned is not the way to word things. You don't show up and tell the patient, hey, guess what? You don't have cancer, because the only word they hear is cancer. I should have said you have a chronic kidney infection, but we can fix that. So he had right nephrectomy, and they found a lot of purulence pus in the right renal fossa, and he got better. So to recap, we talked about acute and recurrent cystitis in women. Entrofurantoin is an excellent drug for treatment and prophylaxis. I don't know where the new oral agents will fit into our guidelines or treatment armamentarium, so I don't think you'll be asked about them. Asymptomatic bacteria, you screen and treat in pregnant women and patients undergoing urologic surgery. Everyone else, don't even test the urine in the first place. Catheter-associated UTI, make sure that you're ensuring adequate drainage. For pylo, treat with a tissue active agent. Don't be tempted to use nitrofurantoin. For urosepsis and worse, if you have emphysematous pilo, you're going to do drainage. If you have emphysematous cystitis, start with medical management. And xanthogranulomatous pilo, you're taking out that kidney. I hope that everything is clear now, but this presentation usually triggers a lot of questions, and you can reach me at my email address.